books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
In association with RNIB Libraries, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, we chat to author Anita Frank about her World War I mystery thriller, The Good Liars. Plus, we find some brand new books in the RNIB Library. That's all coming up on today's Read On. Last on Read On with her book, The Return. It's a welcome return to Anita Frank with her new book, The Good Liars, the Sunday Times best-selling World War I historical fiction murder mystery thriller. The audio version, available both commercially and in the RNIB Library, is read by Kirsten Atherton.
She slams the car's door, then watches as it pulls away, its exhaust fumes cutting into the back of her throat as it disappears down the road, leaving her with only her large case and the trepidation churning in her stomach. For a moment, she considers running after it, waving it to a stop, so she can climb back into the relative safety of its confines. But it is too late for that now. So instead, she watches the purple vapour gradually dissipate until, like the car, it is no longer visible, and the whole episode might have been little more than a fragment of her imagination. She lets out the breath she has been holding and bends to pick up the suitcase at her feet. Its weight drags her down, as if it, too, is intent on anchoring her to the spot. This will not do. She lets out another breath, short and sharp this time, and thrusts out her chin with more determination than she feels, firmly telling herself this is the beginning of an adventure. She will see it through, come what may. There is no going back.
Well, The Good Liars is a dark murder mystery set in 1920, and it centres on the once esteemed Stillwell family of Darkacre Hall, who I think it's fair to say are struggling to come to terms with the legacy of the First World War. But their already troubled lives are thrown into further disarray when police decide to reopen the case of a young boy who vanished in the summer of 1914. And suddenly they find themselves facing the scrutiny of Detective Sergeant Verity, who wears a painted copper mask to conceal the facial injuries that he sustained during the war. And if that wasn't unsettling enough, peculiar incidents begin to happen that lead the family to fear the dead may be returning to Darkacre. And as old resentments flare, secrets risk being unearthed that could destroy them all.
Clutching her handbag, her stomach knotted, she mounted the steps and pushed open the door. The murmurous chatter inside stilled immediately. Heat rose in her cheeks as eyes turned upon her. Mouths pinched with displeasure, eyebrows hitched with surprise, foreheads furrowed. On seeing more than one head shake with disgust, she almost turned tail and ran. Then she thought of her boy, her beautiful boy. Wave of anger enveloped her. Her son was as good as theirs, better even. Better than most, certainly. Buoyed with defiance, she walked through them all to take her place in the queue. Heart hammering, she inched forward, waiting her turn. She tried to ignore the whispered comments and pointed stares, but each broke through her fragile defences to land a brutal blow. At last, she found herself facing the Reverend, a ledger spread wide before him, a cash box to his side. Before she could lose her nerve, she opened her bag and placed her hard-earned money upon the table.
"That's my donation."
The Reverend had the good grace to look uncomfortable.
"I'm afraid we cannot accept it." "Why not?"
she demanded, a quiver in her voice.
"My money's as good as the next man's."
"What seems to be the problem?"
Councillor Jones asked, breaking free from a cluster of onlookers. Her mouth dry, she turned to face him.
I've come to pay my money. My son served his country. His name deserves to be on the memorial, along with the other boys from the village who fought and gave their lives.
Reaching down, he swept the money back towards her.
This memorial is to record the names of the glorious dead, those honourably fallen. Men the community wishes to remember and is proud to do so.
How did you come up with the name for the place, for Dark Acre?
Dark Acre. It wasn't originally called Dark Acre. I think I had very unimaginatively called it Southerton Hall when I first submitted it to my editor. And she said, I love the book, but, you know, it's got to be something catchier than Southerton Hall. And we were throwing around with my agent different ideas. You know, he quite liked the idea of having Fox in the title, so Foxwood House or something like that. And I actually ended up getting an AA map and going through the list of all the towns and villages in the back for inspiration. And I came across Darkacre. And I thought, well, that's perfect, isn't it? Darkacre Hall. So I suggested that. And it was, definitely the one that ticked all the boxes.
Now, you mentioned towns and villages in the back. One thing every town and village will have, or almost all will have, is a war memorial. And the book starts with something that never occurred to me, that some people who died in the war maybe didn't get their names on the local war memorials.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that has always fascinated me about the First World War. So there are lots of things that I've always found particularly interesting about this period of time, from, you know, Kitchener's army and the patriotism that surged through the country, to conscription, to the handing out of white feathers, to the rise of spiritualism, and war memorials, and who got to be on them and who didn't. And this was one of the things that, you know, I wanted to work into the book. So I took all of those aspects that I really loved and I incorporated them all into one story. That's what I wanted to do.
I lost two sons on the Somme, and quite frankly, it would be an insult to their memory and to the memory of all the other brave boys who died so courageously to have the likes of your son listed alongside them. No, unless you wish to make a donation as an act of remorse, I suggest you show some common decency and leave.
My son has a right.
Your son is a disgrace, madam.
The words knocked the wind from her lungs. Her throat ached as tears blurred her vision, but she would not let them fall. She would not give him, give any of them, the satisfaction. Instead, she fostered her rage, fanning its flames with indignation and resentment as she scooped the spurned notes and coins back into her bag. Later, she would be unable to recall the words she shouted as she left the hall, though she would be able to remember every insult thrown after her, every derogatory comment made about her boy. She would not remember how she made it home, but she would remember her knees buckling as she closed the door behind her.
Of a family that doesn't have any war stories, because my grandparents and great-grandparents were either working on ships or working down the mines, but the white feathers were given to people who maybe didn't need to sign up, which is what Ida did, and maybe the rest of the village doesn't like her very much for that.
That's right. I always found this, as I say, a very interesting aspect, that everybody wanted to jump on this bandwagon of patriotism and being seen to be doing their bit. And of course, for frustrated young women, what they could do was hand out these white feathers and make men feel guilty for not being in the army, for not doing their bit. And you do read these accounts of men who were working for the war effort in government and so on, but wouldn't necessarily be in a uniformed position. And it actually started being the case that they would request uniforms, because if they were out in the street in normal civvy suits, that people would come up to them, or women would come up to them and hand them white feathers, not realizing that they were actually hard at work for the war effort in a different capacity. So increasingly, there was this sort of need for everyone to be seen to be wearing a uniform. But these women were indiscriminate in the way that they handed out their white feathers. And of course, there were a lot of people who were in occupations that meant they didn't have to fight. I mean, my own background is obviously I'm a farmer's daughter. And so I don't have a history of soldiers in my family because they were all working the land, feeding the country. That was their contribution to the war effort in the First and the Second World War. But there were others who had medical issues, which meant they weren't fit for service, for active service. And then, of course, you did have people who perhaps didn't look their age. So they were actually too young to be fighting, but they might have looked like they should have been in uniform. So they were also possible targets for these women with their white feathers. So it's just a really interesting area that, you know, and it wounded so deeply that a lot of people, even though they had legitimate reasons for not being in the military, but because they are handed out these white feathers, that sense of guilt and failure is so profound that they find themselves almost trying to cheat the system in order to get to the front and to feel like they're doing the right thing.
And we'll have more from my chat with Anita Frank later in the show.
This is an RNIB talking book.
Murder Under the Sun, written by Agatha Christie.
The Adventures of Sherlock Holmes by Sir Arthur Conan Doyle.
Brazil by Michael Palin.
Every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. enjoy a classic from the RNIB Talking Books Library.
Black Beauty by Anna Sewell.
Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte.
Plus, you can enjoy A Book for the Younger Listener or Young at Heart every Saturday at 9 a.m. with a repeat on Sundays at 3 p.m. and Tuesdays at 6 p.m.
Alice's Adventures in Wonderland by Lewis Carroll.
Anne of Green Gables by L.M. Montgomery.
Enjoy your favourite talking books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now on Read On, let's take our first visit to the RNIB Library to find some brand new books.
Thanks to the kind donations from many of UK's audio publishers, it can be hard to keep up with all the great new books entering the Talking Books Library. So here are two new gems.
Publisher Hodder have given us the autobiography of newsreader Clive Myrie. Everything is Everything, a memoir of love, hate and hope.
My mother was a primary school and kindergarten teacher in Jamaica, a profession she'd had her eye on since her late teens. She taught everything, English, maths, reading, writing. Her favourite subject was Bible studies, partly because all the kids in Jamaican households had no problem getting hold of a copy of the textbook. She loved learning and imparting her knowledge to young minds, getting a kick out of seeing pupils develop and shine, helping budding flowers open and bloom with well-chosen words and attention. The naughty, those with attention deficits, the sporty, the overexcited, the easily bored, the rebels, the can't-keep-stills, the rich and poor and lazy and determined and gifted and bright and slow. My mum loved children, and they loved her classes. She knew how to reach every one of them, and it was her calling. But teaching was also a profession in Jamaica that was held in very high regard, a vital, even noble pursuit. Teachers were respected because they were offering something the British overlords had denied for hundreds of years: opportunity.
As a Bolton teenager with a paper round, Clive Myrie read all the newspapers he delivered from cover to cover and dreamed of becoming a journalist. In this deeply personal memoir, he tells how his family history has influenced his view of the world, introducing us to his Windrush generation parents, a great-grandfather who helped build the Panama Canal, and a great-uncle who fought in the First World War, later to become a prominent police detective in Jamaica. He reflects on how being black has affected his perspective on issues he's encountered in 30 years reporting some of the biggest stories of our time, most recently from Ukraine and Israel. showing us how those experiences gave him a better idea of what it means to be an outsider. He tells of his pride in his roots, but his determination not to be defined by his background in dealing with the challenges of race and class, to succeed at the highest level. Moving, engaging, revealing, Everything is Everything is a story of love and hate, but also hope.
Black teachers were a symbol of change. British rule since the 1830s had decreed so-called Negro education as a provision for regulating the condition of the Negroes as may combine their welfare with the interests of the proprietors, whose interest, of course, was to carry on the production of sugar. In other words, black people received no real education at all, except better to work the cane fields. By 1962, the year my mother left for Britain, and the year of Jamaican independence, 67% of the population could not read or write. Mum hoped that working in a school in England would give her the status and respect she enjoyed back in Jamaica. She wouldn't be another immigrant drifting from job to job on the outside of society. She would be a core citizen on the inside, helping fulfill the dreams of countless parents, a fundamental cog in the wheel of the community. She had nursed her dream of teaching in England while making all her plans for the big move to Bolton, and teaching would underpin her new existence. Unlike Hortense in Andrea Levy's novel Small Island, Mum knew before she flew to England that her Jamaican qualifications would not be considered good enough for a teaching post in Britain, and she would have to retrain. But she told herself it wouldn't be a problem. She would take evening classes if necessary, while working during the day, perhaps as a seamstress to bring home a little extra money. Teaching was something my mum had set her heart on, and in Bolton she would work to achieve that goal. However, my mum didn't fully appreciate how much time the retraining would take to get the right qualifications. In those first few months in Bolton, my dad was struggling to hold on to work, and Mum was beginning to realise that she needed to contribute forcefully to the family income.
Everything is Everything is written and read by Clive Myrie and runs for 9 hours and 9 minutes.
We have Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind by historian Tom Holland. It was donated by Little Brown.
At one of the narrowest points on the Hellespont, the thin channel of water that snakes from the Aegean up towards the Black Sea and separates Europe from Asia, a promontory known as the Dog's Tail extended from the European shore. Here, 480 years before the birth of Christ, a feat so astonishing as to seem the work of a god had been completed. Twin pontoon bridges, stretching from the Asian shore to the tip of the Dog's Tail, had yoked the two continents together. That none but a monarch of infinite resources could possibly have tamed the currents of the sea in so imperious a manner went without saying. Xerxes, the king of Persia, ruled the largest empire that the world had ever seen. From the Aegean to the Hindu Kush, all the teeming hordes of Asia marched at his command. Going to war, he could summon forces that were said to drink entire rivers dry. Few had doubted, watching Xerxes cross the Hellespont, that the whole continent beyond would soon be his.
Christianity is the most enduring and influential legacy of the ancient world, and its emergence the single most transformative development in Western history. Even the increasing number in the West today who have abandoned the faith of their forebears and dismiss all religion as pointless superstition remain recognisably its heirs. Seen close up, the division between the sceptic and a believer may seem unbridgeable. Widen the focus, though, and Christianity's enduring impact upon the West can be seen in the emergence of much that has traditionally been cast as its nemesis, in science, in secularism, and yes, even in atheism. And that is why Dominion will place the story of how we came to be what we are and how we think the way we do in the broadest historical context, ranging in time from the Persian invasion of Greece in 480 BC to the ongoing migration crisis in Europe today, and from Nebuchadnezzar to the Beatles. It will explore just what it was that made Christianity so revolutionary and disruptive, and how completely it came to saturate the mindset of Latin Christendom, and why in a West that has become increasingly doubtful of religion's claims, so many of its instincts remain irredeemably Christian.
1 year on, the bridges were gone. So too were Xerxes' hopes of conquering Europe. Invading Greece, he had captured Athens, but the torching of the city was to prove the high point of his campaign. Defeat by sea and land had forced a Persian retreat. Xerxes himself had returned to Asia. On the Hellespont, where command of the strait had been entrusted to a governor named Artaictes, there was particular alarm. He knew himself, in the wake of the debacle in Greece, ominously exposed. Sure enough, late in the summer of 479, a squadron of Athenian ships came gliding up the Hellespont. When they moored beside the Dog's Tail, Artaictes first barricaded himself inside the nearest stronghold, and then, after a lengthy siege, made a break for safety, accompanied by his son. Despite a successful escape in the dead of night, they did not get far.
Dominion, The Making of the Western Mind by Tom Holland, is read by Mark Meadows and runs for 22 hours and 17 minutes.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
This is an RNIB talking book.
History of the Talking Book Service and Studios. What happens in the Talking Book Studios when the narrator makes a mistake?
What the engineer used to have to do is stop the tape, wind the tape back a little bit, listen to a place where we could slot the reader back in again, tell the reader where we wanted him to start, play the tape, and at the same time as putting a cue light on, we used to put the player into record, therefore rubbing out the mistake and recording the whole thing correctly. So what we're left with is a tape which was 2 hours long, one side of tape was 2 hours, without any mistakes whatsoever. Most speech studios will come along and edit all the books afterwards, but in the way we did it, we were able to say right at the end of the book, that's it, we haven't got any more work to do, and it was a perfect finish.
And I've been reading for RNIB, How's that? Does that work?
The new digital Bokingtuk?
Bokingtuk, yeah. It's a new word.
I enjoyed doing this sort of thing for its own sake. And if...
Today, RNIB Talking Books are part of the RNIB National Library Service, offering books in audio, braille and giant print, along with many other benefits such as braille music scores, giant print sheet music, online forums and much more. Joining is simple. If you're eligible to join, call 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk. That's 0303 123 9999 or email library@rnib.org.uk.
Talking Books on RNIB Connect Radio.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
And now on Read On, more with my chat with author Anita Frank on our book, The Good Liars. Another thing that didn't occur to me, this is more to do with your book, The Return, rather than the Good Liars, but that there are parallel lines, that men who were very young coming back, maybe they'd started a family, maybe they left when their partner was pregnant, but they'd come back to a 4 or 5 year old child who didn't know them. There was a stranger coming back to live in their house.
Yeah, absolutely. And as you rightly say, you know, this is one of the themes of The Return, where you've got just that situation. And I sort of came across this because, again, it's all these aspects of war and service that you don't really think about until you suddenly stumble across it. And I had been years ago watching a documentary. I didn't even catch the beginning of it. I sort of joined this documentary halfway through on TV, and those years before iPlayer where you can go back to the beginning. It was discussing just that aspect and interviewing a chap whose dad had come home after the war, and he didn't know his father, and he was absolutely terrified of him. And I thought, again, that's another fascinating thing to sort of work with in a story, because there are these very human aspects of war and the result of war that we often just don't think about because we haven't experienced it. So why would we? It's all this nitty gritty little bits and pieces that come together to create that profound experience for those who went through it. So I think it's really interesting to explore those aspects of conflict that often get overlooked.
One thing I think maybe is overlooked is the fact that RNIB Talking Books is a direct result of veterans coming back from the front line in the First World War who've lost their sight. They either through gas or through shell fragments or for whatever reason they lost their sight during the fighting. So it wasn't till right about the time of the Second World War that the books actually started coming out. But your book deals with other sorts of disability. There's the early days of post-traumatic stress disorder, or what they used to call shell shock, and also the early days of caring for someone with multiple disabilities in the book.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. And again, this was another aspect of the First World War that had always interested me, was the medical advances that were made as a direct result of the horrendous experiences that so many men fighting went through. And it's interesting because obviously the First World War is effectively the first industrialized conflict. But because our system of transporting the wounded from the front to the rear had improved so much in previous conflicts and was sort of finally honed during the First World War, we had for the first time had that experience of men surviving wounds that normally would have killed them. And medicine was sort of running to catch up with what you do next, because it's not just simply good enough to, you know, we'd learn how to do amputations and things like that, but it's how you then improve the quality of life for people who have suffered these horrific injuries thereafter. And also that responsibility that these people have sacrificed so much for their country and for all of us. What responsibility do we have to try and make the very best job we can of improving their lives and trying to ameliorate the effects of these horrific injuries? So during the First World War, as you rightly say, I've got a triple amputee in the book, and there were huge advances made throughout the conflict and after in artificial limbs, for example, which were very old-fashioned and clunky at the beginning and had improved considerably by the end of the conflict, but also facial injuries, which were kind of a new thing because of the nature of war and shell blasts and shrapnel and all of that, that you started off. My character has a copper mask, a painted copper mask, which were often used to conceal the devastation to the face. But obviously at this time as well, huge advances were being made in plastic surgery. And there was a real experimental surge in what could be achieved to recreate the face and how to grow new flesh and new skin and how to create a nose or a chin or an eye socket from other bits of bone grafted from elsewhere and things like that. So there was a huge desire to try and do the best for these men as was possible. And I you know, it's heartening the advances that have been made, but a lot of our medical advances today, as you say, stem from that First World War experience.
Now, these characters all appear in quite a gothic novel, but the research does seem to be quite extensive. How do you balance the accuracy of research with your creative freedom?
I think for me, you know, I always feel a bit guilty because it's not like I've done specific research. I think because I have been studying history, you know, obviously from school right through university, and then it's always been a passion of mine. So I've always sort of carried on watching documentaries and reading histories and memoirs and all the rest of it. So it's not like there's one specific thing that I've done with research. It's just been an ongoing love of history and the subject throughout my life. And I've just accumulated and stored away all of this knowledge. And then when I need more specific bits, if I'm writing and I need to do a deep dive, I'll just, you know, stop then and do a deep dive and then put what is necessary into the book. And it is a balance finding, you know, what you actually need to include versus what the story actually needs. So, you know, I think sometimes you can read a book and you can see that there's a lot of historical detail in there because it's almost as if the author has done the research and has said, well, I've spent all the hours doing this, I'm jolly well going to put it in. But it doesn't necessarily always enrich the story. And I think certainly for me, I want to put enough in to give a flavour of the period, certainly, but I want to put enough in to make the reader confident that I have done my research, that I that they can trust what I'm telling them, but I don't want to bog down the story with unnecessary bits of information, but just enough to for a reader to feel secure in that environment and what they're being told. There is a Gothic feel, I suppose, to the book, but I think it's sort of, there are so many elements within the story that sort of lend themselves to that type of novel anyway. But I did very much want to create that sense of this crumbling mansion because the family are suffering from double death duties, which again stems from losses in the First World War. So it's not a grand mansion. This is a family who, as many did at the time, were being financially impacted as well by the First World War and the ramifications of what had happened. And that creates that sort of slightly drab and dreary and crumbling manor house that all the action takes place in.
Now, the return was around about the Second World War, but your previous novel before this one, The Lost Ones, was around the First World War. I know the timings are slightly different, but what brought you back to that era again for The Good Liars?
Yeah, and I have to say, the book I've just finished writing is also First World War. I do love this period because for me, it's got one step in almost like the romanticism of the Victorian era, but it's also got one foot in the modern age as well. So it's sort of, it's just like a changing of the guard period. And so you've got all those lovely elements, like you've still got horse-drawn vehicles, you've got ladies in long dresses and, you know, the long hair and certain social mores are still being adhered to. But you've also increasingly got those modern aspects that we recognise today with increased motor vehicles, for example, and technology. You've got telephones and things like that. So it's the way that this sort of period, as I say, straddles that sort of old world versus the new world. And I rather like that. It's, to me, it's a very romantic period where it hasn't got completely lost in the modernity that you get from sort of 1925 onwards, when skirts go up and the hair gets shorter and there's certainly loads more motor vehicles and you've got the dawning of film and all the rest of it. But also, I think what attracts me to wartime periods is that I'm particularly interested in women's history and women's experience. And through necessity, women are offered opportunities in wartime periods that they often wouldn't otherwise have had. And it's just a chance for women to show what they're made of and what they're capable of and to show their mettle. And I really enjoy that and exploring those changes and the impact of those changes on the female experience.
A shoulder-high flint wall borders the road, containing the dense woodland that stretches behind it. It is broken by two frost-cracked brick pillars that hail the start of a driveway, one of which bears a wooden sign announcing Dark Acre Hall. No doubt it had once been pristine, a gleaming white background with ornately scrawled letters in glistening black paint. But now the wooden panel shows signs of rot, and what remains of the lettering has faded to shades of grey, so that it takes an educated guess to confirm she is in the right place.
We've heard some clips of Kirsten Atherton's narration of the book. Were you involved in her casting?
Only very briefly. What usually happens with a book is I'm sent maybe a short list of three voice actors. With Kirsten's, they had actually hoped to secure Olivia, who did the narration for The Lost Ones, but she wasn't able to do it. And as a result, they had gone to Kristen. And so I was just sent an example of Kristen's work. And I thought she sounded great. So we sort of went with her instead.
Now, one thing we'll miss if we download the book from the RNIB library is the cover. Can you give us a little description of the cover?
Yes, certainly. So it's got that sort of 1920s feel to it, I think it's fair to say. And it's in a lovely peacock blue and emerald green. And there is a cut glass decanter, which I suppose they took things that appear within the book. So there's a cut glass decanter. There's some white feathers floating down beside it. And then we have a lady and a man sat enjoying a cocktail and playing cards as a chap behind them, paces behind them, interrogating them, which I think is alluding to Detective Sergeant Verity.
A pair of wrought iron gates, bleeding rust from beneath their scraped epidermis, sag open either side. And as she approaches, she notes the tangled weeds entwined around their bottom edge, suggesting they have stood undisturbed for some time. She feels a stir of foreboding as she passes through them.
Another clip of Kristen Arterton reading from The Good Liars by Anita Frank, available from RNIB Talking Books. And Anita, thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me on.
And Anita will be back at the end of the show with some book recommendations in Books of My Life.
For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Now let's return to the RNIB library for two more brand new books.
We have The Siege, the remarkable story of the greatest SAS hostage drama by Ben McIntyre, which was donated by Penguin Random House.
This is a true story of people thrust into a dangerous situation they could not control. A group of strangers who suddenly found themselves captive and besieged. As always in such circumstances, individuals reacted differently. With courage, cowardice, resilience, terror, desperation, or humour, even the perpetrators were swept along by events in ways they did not anticipate or fully understand. The Iranian embassy siege gripped the world and immediately entered national mythology in Britain. For millions, it became a historical watershed, a "where were you when it happened" moment, like the JFK assassination or 9/11. Via the new miracle of live television news, the drama was played out on screens in homes up and down the country, day by day, hour by hour, minute by minute.
On April the 30th, 1980, six heavily armed gunmen burst into the Iranian embassy on Prince's Gate overlooking Hyde Park in London. There they took 26 hostages, including embassy staff, visitors and three British citizens. A tense 6-day siege ensued as millions gathered around the screens across the country to witness the longest news flash in British television history, in which police negotiators and psychiatrists sought a bloodless end to the standoff, while the SAS, hitherto an organisation shrouded in secrecy, laid plans for a daring rescue mission, Operation Nimrod. Drawing on unpublished source material, exclusive interviews with the SAS, and testimony from witnesses including hostages, negotiators, intelligence officers and the on-site psychiatrist, best-selling historian Ben McIntyre takes readers on a gripping journey from the weeks and years of build-up on both sides to the minute-by-minute account of the siege and rescue.
The first ever hostage crisis to be relayed in real time, it marked a turning point in the relationship between breaking news and the viewing public. Like most legends, the episode was presented afterwards as a straightforward morality tale of military daring, civilian bravery, patient police work, and wicked foreign terrorists bent on mayhem. But the siege was more complicated than that, and much more extraordinary. This is not a simple black-and-white moral fable in which the righteous triumph and the losers meet their just deserts. Rather, it is a tale of human error and unintended consequences, the self-replicating tragedy of man's inhumanity to man, and the collision of intolerant beliefs in an era of political, ethnic, and religious violence. The underlying forces that produced the crisis in London more than 40 years ago still agonise and destabilise our world, from Gaza to Iran to Ukraine. Britain had never before faced an international hostage-taking incident on this scale, and the siege changed forever the way terrorism was perceived and dealt with. Everyone involved was tested to a limit invisible to them at the time. Hostages, gunmen, police, journalists, politicians, and the SAS. None knew how the story would end. These were ordinary people, making life or death choices based on instinct and character, for which no training is possible. There are few outright heroes or villains in the siege, only humans, fallible and unpredictable, struggling to survive and subdue a sudden, terrifying storm. This book offers just one universal truth. No one knows how they will respond to lethal jeopardy until they have to.
The Siege, the remarkable story of the greatest SAS hostage drama, is written and read by Ben McIntyre and runs for 14 hours and 28 minutes.
HarperCollins recently gave us Out of Character, From Abigail's Party to Gavin and Stacey and Everything in Between by Alison Steadman.
No, absolutely not. No, I can't wear this. I'm in the bedroom of my digs, staring at myself in the mirror. The reality of what is reflected back at me makes me recoil with embarrassment. Earlier that day, the stage manager had stopped me as I was leaving rehearsals and said, "Here you go. Take this home with you and see what you think." His jaunty enthusiasm should have aroused suspicion, and now here I was, squeezed into a skin-coloured nylon body stocking, like a very unappetising, overfilled sausage, which is not a good look at any age, and certainly not at 23, when you're about to make your professional stage debut. I looked awful.
The first memoir from the National Treasure, critically acclaimed actress and much-loved Gavin and Stacey star. We can all name a beloved iconic character brought to life by the magnificent Alison Steadman. Growing up in post-war, working-class Liverpool, the young Alison, ever the entertainer, would address the world from the stage of her bedroom window until she got a taste for performing in front of an actual audience at her progressive 1960s drama school. By the time she left, her mind was made up. She was going to be an actress, if only she could conquer the onstage giggling. Always pushing boundaries, reclining naked on a sofa in her first role, embracing groundbreaking female characters from day one, Alison has deservedly found acclaim and recognition, succeeding in her TV and theatre career while juggling family life, a difficult feat for any working mother, but particularly for an actress in the 20th century. Alison has proved herself again and again to be a comedy genius. Here, with her distinctive warmth and humour, she vividly recalls all the must-read moments of a life spent in and out of character.
This was a big first moment, and under no circumstances was I going to be impersonating a fry-up favourite. Without giving it a second thought or glance, I peeled off the offending sausage skin and chucked it to one side. When I returned to rehearsals the next day, I told Richard Werrett, the director, "I'll just do it naked." Richard was my tutor at drama school, and he had asked me if I'd play the schoolgirl Sandy Stranger in his production of The Prime of Miss Jean Brodie at Lincoln's Theatre Royal. The show would be taking place during our Easter holidays, and I thought it would be a brilliant opportunity to keep on learning before heading into my final term of training, so I said yes. The prime of Miss Jean Brodie gave me a chance, a first step, and it taught me that I was bold and brave and would always do what felt right for the character, for the production, and for me. That's why I made the decision to reveal all and be my naked self. It was 1969, and despite the massive shift in what was deemed acceptable in culture and society, appearing naked was still a very rare occurrence, and especially so when the bare body was female. Let me set the scene. Sandy is the sitter for a life study being painted by the school's art master, who's part of a love triangle with Sandy's teacher, Miss Brodie. Thankfully, due to the positioning of the chaise longue that I was seated on, the audience couldn't see too much, thank goodness, and the fact that I was lying on my side helped too. The back of the chaise was facing the audience, which meant that my naked 23-year-old self was facing the actor playing the art master. During the run, my original bravura came and went, and I often felt more nervous and exposed than I may have appeared on the surface. When that occurred, I'd conjure images of my mum in my mind's eye. Or should that be my mind's aisle, as Pamela Shipman would say? And her comforting and familiar phrase, never say you can't, always say you can, and you will. And this helped settle me.
Out of Character, from Abigail's Party to Gavin and Stacey and everything in between, is written and read by Alison Steadman and runs for 10 hours and 40 minutes.
For more information, head to rniblibrary.com or call the helpline on 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On, the audiobook show with Robert Kirkwood.
And finally on today's show, a return to Anita Frank for the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Yeah, I think like most people of my sort of age, Enid Blyton was a huge influence. But a bit later on, I absolutely loved the Dragonlance series by Margaret Weiss and Tracy Hickman, which were sort of, I suppose, coming off the back of the popularity of the Dungeons and Dragons board game, which was huge in the mid-80s. I'm giving my age away now. But I loved that. It was sort of a... that world of Lord of the Rings. So you've got your humans and your elves and your dwarves and your magic and your mystery, and that an unlikely band of comrades coming together in the fight of good against evil. But I loved all of the mystery and the magic and the sense of adventure and the courage, and there were some feisty females, and I absolutely adored that series. So I devoured it and certainly found it very inspirational.
Tico Whalen straightened her back with a sigh, flexing her shoulders to ease her cramped muscles. She tossed the soapy bar rag into the water pail and glanced around the empty room. It was getting harder to keep up the old inn. There was a lot of love rubbed into the warm finish of the wood, but even love and tallow couldn't hide the cracks and splits in the well-used tables, or prevent a customer from sitting on an occasional splinter. The inn of the last home was not fancy, not like some she'd heard about in Haven. It was comfortable. The living tree in which it was built wrapped its ancient arms around it lovingly, while the walls and fixtures were crafted around the boughs of the tree with such care as to make it impossible to tell where nature's work left off and man's began. The bar seemed to ebb and flow like a polished wave around the living wood that supported it. The stained glass in the window panes cast welcoming flashes of vibrant color across the room. Shadows were dwindling as noon approached. The inn of the last home would soon be open for business. Tika looked around and smiled in satisfaction. The tables were clean and polished. All she had left to do was sweep the floor. She began to shove aside the heavy wood benches as Otik emerged from the kitchen, enveloped in fragrant steam.
"Should be another brisk day, for both the weather and business," he said, squeezing his stout body behind the bar. He began to set out mugs, whistling cheerfully.
"I'd like the business cooler and the weather warmer," said Tika, tugging at a bench. "I walked my feet off yesterday and got little thanks and less tips. Such a gloomy crowd. Everybody nervous, jumping at every sound. I dropped a mug last night, and I swear, Retark drew his sword."
"Pah!" Otik snorted. "Retark's a solace seeker guard. They're always nervous. You would be too if you had to work for Hedrick, that faint—"
"Watch it," Tika warned.
Otik shrugged.
"Unless the High Theocrat can fly now, he won't be listening to us. I'd hear his boots on the stairs before he could hear me."
But Tika noticed he lowered his voice as he continued.
"The residents of Solace won't put up with much more, mark my words. People disappearing, being dragged off to who knows where. It's a sad time."
He shook his head. Then he brightened.
"But it's good for business."
Paul Boomer reading from Dragons of Autumn Twilight, book one of the Dragonlance Chronicles, which is available commercially.
Is there a book on a rainy day you could happily cuddle up with and reread?
Yeah, I'm not a huge rereader of books, but the most reread book that I have in my collection is Pride and Prejudice. So it would be that, because it's just like returning to an old friend. And it's a brilliant story, but it's the humour contained within it. It makes me laugh out loud when I do reread it. So, yeah, definitely at rain day, it's got to be Pride and Prejudice.
Mr. Bennet's property consisted almost entirely in an estate of 2,000 a year, which, unfortunately for his daughters, was entailed in default of heirs male on a distant relation. And their mother's fortune, though ample for her situation in life, could but ill supply the deficiency of his. Her father had been an attorney in Meryton, and had left her £4,000. She had a sister married to a Mr. Phillips, who had been a clerk to their father, and succeeded him in the business, and a brother settled in London in a respectable line of trade. The village of Longbourn was only 1 mile from Meryton, a most convenient distance for the young ladies, who were usually tempted thither 3 or 4 times a week to pay their duty to their aunt and to a milliner's shop just over the way. The two youngest of the family, Catherine and Lydia, were particularly frequent in these attentions. Their minds were more vacant than their sisters', and when nothing better offered, a walk to Meryton was necessary to amuse their morning hours and furnish conversation for the evening. And however bare of news the country in general might be, they always contrived to learn some from their aunt. At present, indeed, they were well supplied both with news and happiness by the recent arrival of a militia regiment in the neighbourhood. It was to remain the whole winter, and Meryton was the headquarters. Their visits to Mrs. Phillips were now productive of the most interesting intelligence. Every day added something to their knowledge of the officers' names and connections. Their lodgings were not long a secret, and at length they began to know the officers themselves. Mr. Phillips visited them all, and this opened to his nieces a source of felicity unknown before. They could talk of nothing but officers, and Mr. Bingley's large fortune, the mention of which gave animation to their mother, was worthless in their eyes when opposed to the regimentals of an ensign.
Emilia Fox reading Pride and Prejudice by Jane Austen, which is in the RNIB Talking Books Library. And is there something you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently that's fresh in the mind you'd like to recommend.
I would. Now, there's a bit of a wait on this because I was lucky enough to get a proof on it. So it's not actually out until next March. But I would urge people to make a note of it and get a copy as soon as it does come out. And it's called The Fisherman's Gift by Julia Kelly. It's a debut novel and it's set in 1900 in a Scottish fishing village, and it centres on Dorothy, who is the school teacher, but she is a incomer, so she's always been treated as an outsider by the village. And one stormy day, a little boy is rescued from the waves, and he speaks no English, but he bears an uncanny resemblance to Dorothy's little boy, who she lost 15 years previously in the sea. And it's just the most beautifully wrought novel of motherhood, of maternal guilt, of lost love, but also friendship and hope and forgiveness. And honestly, it's just beautiful. And it made me sob uncontrollably. It totally struck a chord with me. And it's so uplifting as well that I would urge people. I know it's a bit of a wait because it's March, but it's one to make note of and get your hands on a copy when it comes out.
So I had to stifle a laugh there because I typed Fisherman's Gift into Amazon to see if I could see if it had an audiobook narrator, and it was just hats and gloves and yes, mugs with fish on them that came up.
I did the same thing myself because I thought, I don't know what the publication date is. So I put it in, and it is. It's just literally Fisherman's Gifts, which I'm sure are great. But that's not the book that I... It's definitely the book.
Yeah, there's a hat there that says Born to Fish. Okay.
You see, they are brilliant Fisherman's Gifts.
Yeah. The Fisherman's Gift by Julia Kelly isn't out until March 2025. I reached out to Julia Kelly, who said she doesn't know who the narrator is as yet, but she says she's excited to find out when the time comes. We'll keep you posted. And once again, Anita, thank you so much.
Thank you ever so much for having me on.
That's all we've got time for on today's edition of Read On. We'll be back at the same time next week, but if you can't wait that long, there are over 400 episodes available as a podcast. Just search for RNIB Read On. And remember to tune in every weekday at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. for our sister show, Talking Books, where we showcase the best that RNIB Library has to offer that we're allowed to play on air. Listen live or catch up online at rnib.org.uk/connect-radio.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.